The Gamer's Haven at gamershavenpodcast.com and Vorpal Network at vorpalnetwork.com are proud to present coverage of Gen Con 2010.
It's game time.
Quiet, please. I am analyzing.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
Is the next step the transplantation of the human brain?
Ballsy. Stupid, but ballsy.
Stand by for action.
Welcome to the party, pal.
Okay.
Remember, we're not dealing with an intelligence on our own level.
Bring in the logic probe!
Ooh!
End of line.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. Huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com. Or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
This is the Vorpal Network.
Or so, talking about copyright and fair use and intellectual property and all that fun stuff. My name is Eric Mersman. I'm an attorney and a gamer, and I practice in Chicago at a firm called Winston & Strawn. I'm an IP litigator, mostly working patents. As a lawyer, I have to give like a disclaimer at the beginning, because that's like what we do. I'm a lawyer, but I'm not your lawyer. My firm is not, doesn't represent you, and the pro bono organization that I'm going to mention, Lawyers for the Creative Arts, they also aren't representing you. My goal here is to help you understand what questions you need to ask your own lawyer, if you do need to ask your own lawyer a question. So nothing I give you today is legal advice.
And so we can get it out of the way. My name is Don Bingle. I'm an attorney also. My law firm requires me to say that I'm not your lawyer, they're not your lawyer. I'm not giving you any legal advice, and please do not give me any confidential information.
So now that we've got that, the fun stuff out of the way.
Small print.
So I'm going to spend most of the time today talking about copyright. I'm going to touch on trademarks and patents a little tiny bit, if we have time for it, but I have a feeling that we're going to all want to talk about copyright. So what is copyright? Copyright protects the original expression of an idea, but not the idea itself. So that's all I have. Are there any questions? No. In order to be protected by copyright, something has to be committed to a fixed, tangible form. Copyright currently lasts until 70 years after the death of the author, if unpublished. If published, it's or if it's a work for hire, it's 95 years after publication or 120 years after creation. So, and that's probably going to be extended again once the copyright on Mickey Mouse comes close to expiring, so we're probably pretty safe for perpetuity for anything we create at this point. Mm-hmm. What can be, and the idea behind copyright is that when that copyright term is over, that whatever you have written or created is now in the public domain. May it rest in peace. So what can be protected by copyright? Literary works, musical works, dramatic works, pantomimes and choreographic works. Just basically anything that you that you are expressing in a tangible form. Sound recordings, architectural works, compilations can be protected by a copyright, even if you're just compiling facts that otherwise would not be copyrightable. So if any of you are here working on the next big Yellow Pages book, then you are in the right place. The idea behind compilations is that it protects the sweat of the brow. And if you are compiling or your work is being put into a compilation of other creative works, the way that works is generally the compiler holds the right, so the person who's putting those works together holds the right to reproduce the compilation, but the individual authors, unless there's some other, you know, exchange or license or what have you, the other authors will retain their own rights. So if anybody says, well, in order for your story to be in this anthology, you need to sign over the copyright to me because that's the law, they are lying to you. So that's kind of the general list. Getting into more specifics, like a question that commonly comes up is like, okay, ideas can't be protected. The expression can. What about a character, right? Can a single character be protected by copyright? And the answer is sometimes. The answer now is usually. The less developed the characters, the less they can be copyrighted is kind of the old standard. Now it's kind of if the character is distinctively delineated or fully developed in the original work, another judge has said, if the character, when placed in a new plot situation, will react in ways that are at once distinctive and unsurprising. So essentially, if you have developed a character, you hold copyright in that character. Now it's a little different than kind of when you hold copyright in... Well, when you think about holding copyright in a book, it's about the words on the page. Like, someone else can't take those words and copy them. Now, there's another part called derivative works that we'll get into. But with characters, it's not quite the same. And that's evolved over time. In fact, originally, a court once held that Sam Spade, for example, was not protectable by copyright. But that's actually been kind of... explicitly at this point said, well, no, that's not how we view it now. One of my favorite character-based decisions, if you're ever in the mood to read a fun legal decision, is Gaiman v. McFarlane.
Oh, yeah.
It's a decision written by Judge Posner in the Seventh Circuit, who's like one of the premier legal minds of our time. And if you ever want to read him talking about neural parasites, that is the decision for you. That case was all about Neil Gaiman was saying that he was a joint copyright holder in Medieval Spawn.
Dark Ages.
The Medieval Dark Ages Spawn. What's that guy's name? Cagliostro? Is that? Mm-hmm. And Angela?
Yeah.
Right? Because he came up with those in a comic book and... there's a whole argument about that, and I'm going to touch on that a little bit more throughout this whole discussion, but one of the arguments was, are those characters themselves even copyrightable? Judge Posner said that they were for various different reasons. What can be protected by copyright? What cannot be? Anything useful? So a useful article where the things that make it art are separable from the things that make it useful. There are a lot of different ways that courts look at this, but probably not too applicable to writers. Like, this is more of kind of a sculptural issue. Like, if you have a very artistic bottle opener, is that protected by copyright? Mm-hmm. Who knows? Literally no one. A lot of the ways that they look at it is kind of what's the primary use of it. The thing that is useful for writers is this concept of the scène à faire, And that's where you have an item that's so rudimentary, commonplace, standard, or unavoidable that it doesn't distinguish anything. So that was actually one of the arguments in the Gaiman v. McFarlane was over Cagliostro. He's like this, I guess, kind of... Well, what McFarlane was saying is he's a drunken bum. Like, that's all he is. He's the drunken bum character. The drunken bum character shows up in every book. You know, like, that's not... Neil Gaiman did not invent the drunken bum character. So the idea of a stock character is not... You can't protect a stock character by copyright. Now, once you kind of turn a stock character into something distinctive, like, once you say, well, you know, Cagliostro's not just a drunk bum, he's actually, you know, an immortal count, and, you know, this is exactly what he looks like, kind of the penciler gives him shape, and, you know, he comes to life as something where you can say that somebody else doing a drunken bum character is not infringing on Cagliostro, right? Once you make him distinctive, then that character is protected, but that doesn't mean that you have the rights to every drunken bum in the world. And Senefair doesn't just apply to characters either, you know, it applies to, well, I mean, literally, it's just, I think, scenes of work or something in French. So it's literally just like scenes that just appear in, you know, every single book, of which I don't have any examples written down, and I'm totally blanking right now, but I'm sure I'll come up with something. So what? The player characters meeting the NPC in a tavern, for example. No one can copyright that scene. They might be able to copyright specific versions of that scene, but no one can say like I invented the tavern scene. So, what rights does copyright convey? Reproduce and copy is right there in the name. Distribute those copies, perform a publicly display, and the kicker, the kind of really important thing that I think is what we all want to talk about today, are preparing derivative works. So the way derivative works, broadly speaking, just includes any form where a work is recast, transformed, or adapted. So a translation, a movie adaptation, anything like that, it's really obvious. Where you get into more confusion are, you know, kind of the unauthorized sequel, the character crossover situation, the shared world fiction, things like that, still fall within derivative works. The thing about derivative works is once you have permission to make it, your derivative work can be independently copyrightable as well. Which I think is why the actual Invisible Man couldn't appear in Leave a Shorter Gentleman movie, right? Because even though the literary character had passed into the public domain, there was a derivative work that was itself independently copyrightable, so therefore they had to make up the horrible guy that was... I'm sorry if any of you thought that character contributed to the film.
By the way, one of the reasons that if you go see Wicked, and obviously it takes off from The Wizard of Oz, and Frank Baum is in public domain now, but the movie isn't, and they're very careful in various parts of that play not to track to the movie.
Well, and the fun thing is now Wicked is, of course, also not in the public domain, the book, and the play is not in public domain either, so we're, you know, that's the fun way that derivative works can kind of build new walls around something that we all feel we should have access to.
The major question I'm wondering about is, if you're, say, creating a fantasy or sci-fi or something, and you want to create a different world, different set of characters, but you want to pull in say, a race or something, exactly how it is in a different book. So, like orcs, or like how dragons are in D&D.
Right.
Can you do that?
Well, I mean, there are a couple different things that come into play there. One is that, what is that item, whatever it is you're bringing in? I mean, it could be a race, a world, specific character. Is that something that is already protected by copyright? So, you know, like, if you wanted to bring in, I can't speak to orcs specifically. I'm pretty sure, like, the general concept of orc is in the public domain, but I know there are specific instances where people have asserted that this is too much of an exact copy of my orc. Mm-hmm. Sure. And there's a KC issue, I think, right? ORC versus ORK. Maybe I'm making that up.
But I mean, this is why if you've got an early edition of the Dungeons & Dragons Monster Manual with Cthulhu in it as a monster, you got a collector's item because you state of H.P. Lovecraft said, no, can't put Cthulhu in your book. We own it. We protect it. And things like that. I mean, you get issues with halflings versus hobbits and Kender and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, it takes a little bit of care. I think you're probably pretty safe with orcs as a concept. But, you know, you got to be careful when you're talking about you want to pull over something from somebody else's system. You know, it's kind of like, well, are you pulling over the concept of, you know, these kind of grimy little creatures? Or are you pulling over stats? Are you pulling over a hierarchy of the organization? Are you pulling over a religion that somebody else made up and is protectable? Are you, you know, pulling over the mechanics of the game system or the history of the orcs that they may have put in their fictional work, all of which may be protected? I discourage anyone from wholesale going out and grabbing something from somebody else. It's, you know, one, whether or not it is protectable and illegal, it's disrespectful. And, you know, we're probably going to get to this, but, you know, that's the way I feel about fan fiction. Not only, by the way, is it a breach of copyright, it's disrespectful to the author.
And, the real thing that kind of, that set off warning lights in my mind was just that you used the word that you wanted to pull it over. You know, you want, for example, dragons exactly the way they are in D&D. That's going to set off warning bells no matter what. You know, if you have your, you know, metallics versus your chromatics. Yeah. If you put that in your book, you are going to get a letter from a Wizards of the Coast attorney. Uh-huh. I would be surprised if you didn't.
Now, maybe not fancy, but I could envision a fiction story where someone's walking into a Oklahoma bar and the bar is playing Friends in Low Places. Now, does Garth Brooks write you a letter because his song is in it? As long as you state exactly that song's playing on the jukebox. Is that an issue?
That's playing on the jukebox? Well, or
As long as you're not saying the lyric, but that is setting the setting.
He doesn't hold copyright in the title of his song.
As long as you don't say the lyrics themselves. Or you can even use the lyrics as long as you're not using it as your title for the book.
No,
you
can say, don't use the lyrics.
Like, yeah, your best bet is to not use.
Just refer to that actual. Okay.
So, how do you get a character to quote something? Like, if a character's trying to quote a famous line of a play or trying to quote something else that's copyrighted.
You can't always get what you want.
Yeah, you hope that your character knows a lot of public domain plays.
That's why Star Trek
is a fan. You know what, though? I mean, I had a character once say, they're trying to deal with the situation, and he says, well, nuke the planet from orbit. That's the only way to be sure, which is a line from Aliens. And, you know, but I had the character say, you know, I had them reference the movie then. Yeah. It's kind of like, you know, you got to follow the advice from Aliens. Nuke the whole planet. It's the only way to be sure. And it's a little, you know, it's a little riff. It, you know, the rest of the book has nothing to do with Aliens. I'm very comfortable that that constitutes fair use.
Yeah. Okay. And I mean, this is something we said in our last talk, we haven't said it here yet, is that, you know, the question, can somebody sue me for blank? The answer to that question is always yes. You know, so is it possible that Don is someday going to get a cease and desist letter about that quote from Aliens? It could happen, you know.
Could they sue me? Yes. Would they win? Probably no. Would it be a fuss and bother if they did? Yes. Would it cost me money? Yes. But I'd weigh the probability of that against, you know, the fact that the characters would say that because they are young males in a given situation.
Yeah.
So what's the difference between licensing and copyright? Or does licensing come along with copyright?
Right, so you can license your copyright or any of your rights that you hold under copyright. You can license those to someone else. So if you wanted, you could sell your whole copyright outright to someone else. Or you could say, okay, you're my publisher, so I give you license to reproduce this work. Or, you know, someone says, hey, I want to write a movie about your book. I'll give you $1 million for the movie rights. You say, okay, here's the license to the movie rights. It's just kind of a way to talk about the agreement between you and another person for parts of the rights that you hold as a copyright holder.
When you're talking about derivative works, it's pretty clear that reading text would be a derivative work. Is changing that text from a piece of paper to a digital format or between digital formats count as a digital work? I think it was in contest, but I'm not sure.
Usually that's just straight up considered a reproduction.
Okay.
It's not considered a derivative work, which is one of the primary rights of copyright.
So reproducing something written if you don't own the copyright is a copyright violation.
Well, I mean that,
and writing a derivative work is also a copyright violation. It's a different type of copyright violation.
Yeah.
I meant that in the context of if I sell selling my text rights or the reproduction rights, is that how tied to that is a format as the law stands right now?
Well, when you sell a story or a book, they will be very specific in the contract generally about what they are licensing. Sometimes they'll say we want all rights to the copyright worldwide in perpetuity. Fine. You know, that's everything. You've now sold everything, licensed everything to them. But they may say we want first use rights in the English language, in print and in electronic format, and in North America for 1 year, and a non-exclusive right to reproduce it in any form anywhere after that. So they still have rights after the year, but their exclusive rights go away at the end of 1 year. And sometimes they'll ask for translation. You know, since a lot of contracts were developed before electronic means were around, a lot of them were very unclear about what they covered when electronics came around. Now the people are being very careful to cover everything, and you will see people, by the way, who don't talk about worldwide rights, they talk about universal rights. You know, well, are they thinking ahead, or are they been reading too much genre fiction? I don't know. But yeah, they will talk about being reproduced in any form by electronic media or otherwise.
So if it doesn't say it specifically, I've not sold it. Is that pretty much?
Well, it depends on what you said specifically.
Like, for example, if it says text, or, you know, I'm selling you the rights to put this in your magazine, I automatically keep everything else. If I say, you can print it in your magazine once, everything else stays mine.
If that's what it says. But if you just say, I'm selling this so you can print it in the magazine, I think it's woefully unclear as to whether that's exclusive or non-exclusive, whether that means in the print magazine or in electronic things. You know, Dragon had the big thing some years ago about whether they could reprint, or whether they could then post in electronic form articles that have been written for Dragon Magazine in earlier issues, and they ended up settling that. So it, you kind of don't want to be in a position where, well, if it doesn't say it, then I haven't sold it. You really want to be in a position where it says what you sold, very specifically.
Okay.
Something that might resonate with the audience is, you know, as writers, creative people, and role players, we all have plenty of characters that we've created for games, some games which are now defunct, that, you know, we might want to rewrite the character and as a main character in a book, you know, but we know we're not going to be able to sell a book set in the world of defunct game no one plays, you know, like, and we're going to change it, of course, but do you, you know, courtesy call out to the makers of the game and say, you know, this is kind of what I'm doing, and, you know, like, do you ask permission and or beg forgiveness?
Just because you created a character that used a game system doesn't necessarily mean that they have any rights to the character as a character. If you want to say, if you want to, for example, put that character out as a character in a different role-playing game system and you want to use the stats and the mechanics and the stuff that came from the game company, then I think you have a worry. But, you know, if you've been playing Bobar the Orc in your AD&D campaign and you want to do a fantasy about Bobar the Orc goes to space, you know, whatever, I'm not terribly concerned that Dungeons & Dragons is going to come after you. It's when you go after their very... the stuff that they are careful about protecting, you know, which is, you know, if it was instead Bobar the Kender, I'd worry, because I think the Dragonlance people have probably been pretty good about protecting Kenders as a copyright protected character race, and so I would worry about sending Bobar the Kender out. But if I was, you know, going to make you know, Bobar the elf sprout, the elf sprite or whatever, that was similar to the character I played, I wouldn't worry so much about that. He's nodding. I'm not the IP player. I mean, I'm talking too much. But.
I don't know that I would consider a character made for a role playing game as a, like, as a derivative work of that role playing game.
Well, like, those of us who are, you know, writers, we create our characters, we try and bind them into the world. And if the world has a really specific setting, like Midnight, where Sauron won the Lord of the Rings War, essentially, you know, like, and he hunts down magic users. So, like, you're going to use some of the similar things to make your story really good, but those are world-building ideas that the company made. Like, you know, that sounds dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, what you're talking about bringing in, you know, whole hog, again, I think the closest analysis to this is the Santa Fe thing that we talked about. You know, are you talking about something that is very specific to this world? Are you talking about, you know, magic hunters being persecuted? That's not, nobody holds the copyright to a world in which magic hunters are persecuted by a tyrannical overlord. A specific tyrannical overlord that hunts magic users in a specific way, you know, with a specific history of magic hunter or magic user hunting, then you start to get out of the Senefair world and more into something that's actually protected by copyright.
And I guess I want to say other things about using gaming characters. You know, everybody knows that when Dragonlance was written, They role-played, they ran it as a game, and they picked up things about the characters from the people who played it in that game. That's very cool and very nice, and I'm sure, you know what, that they had a written release. You not only have to worry about people at Wizards of the Coast, I suppose, going after you if you do something that infringes on your rights. If you are going to make up a fantasy quest that's based on your gaming experience, you may need to worry about your friends getting pissed off and saying that you stole stuff from them. I'm not kidding. It can happen. And so you need to think about that.
I was wondering about the, you were saying some of the specifics, you know, hunting in a certain way or whatever. So everybody has, you know, stake the vampire in the heart, or trolls are killed by fire and acid, or stuff along those lines. They're in some game mechanics, but is that just because it's spread out so far, no one owns the copyright to it?
Well, I mean, I think vampire stake in the heart is
a few hundred years old.
It's pretty old.
pretty
I don't know the specifics, the specific sociological origins of trolls and fire, but again, you're getting into.
It's like the orcs and stuff. It's as long as you're not using exactly the same description as someone else or close enough for them to say.
Yeah, if you need your trolls to get burned by fire, you're probably not gonna get a letter from.
Yeah.
Wizards of the Coast, or whoever actually
Christopher Tolkien
first came up with Trolls and Fire. Yeah.
So basically, if you can find something that's published in multiple books or something, then you're pretty safe using that.
Unless they happen to have got the permission
but
of
if
the first
only
person.
In like one series.
Or yeah,
something,
I mean,
then you're probably not.
I think you know you. It's tough to say. That's a question that is. I would say the answer to that is no. Really, you know, you're not necessarily safe pulling something that just because it exists in multiple books.
You don't know if they licensed it. You don't know if they stole it.
Yeah.
You don't know.
Yeah.
You know, just because 800,000 other people are doing fan fiction doesn't mean it's not a violation of the rights when you do fan fiction.
And it could be. Yeah. It could, maybe all those people received letters, or maybe they just decided not to.
Books. Like if you have four or five
people have committed copyright violations in published books. So no, I don't think you necessarily can decide from that you're safe. Your best protection is if you can track that back to public domain in some way.
Yeah.
It's old enough or it's in some story that you know is in public domain.
Well, we've heard Don's views a few times on fan fiction, and I know some authors have flat out said, I don't care as long as people don't make money, and there's some that are like, they have their army of lawyers that hunt you down at your house if you so much as think of writing it. But how's the author supposed to protect themselves if, for some reason, like they've heard of a fan fiction idea and it was already being in the book, but they hadn't published it yet, and so on and so forth? Like, does it cause issues for the author themselves that they stole their fan's idea?
Well, because you have a copyright on a form of expression, as soon as you put it into a document form, you know, yes, do people who write fan fiction have certain copyright protectable interests in what they write? The answer is yes, they do, but they are also violating somebody else's copyright, and I think. So, you know, what was used? Was it an aspect of the character that was owned by the original holder that is a legitimate derivative work? Is it some other unique piece? I think that most people who allow fan fiction and don't persecute it avoid ever looking at it. And it's kind of, by the way, the same thing. If you're trying to sell a screenplay or something to Hollywood, and you send it to somebody, you'll, odds are, get a letter back from them or their, you know, lawyers or somebody, and it says, we haven't read this, we won't read this, nobody it has anything to do with our production has read it, and our policy is not to read it because we don't want you to sue us later, even though you might be unsuccessful.
The person who wrote this letter actually can't read.
He's not allowed to talk to anybody in the rest of the company because we want no possibility that this idea has moved from here
and
to here.
And there's also an idea of it's not enshrined in the copyright law, but it's this idea of unclean hands, that while you're infringing somebody else's copyright, it poses problems for you of asserting that copyrighted work that comes out of you infringing somebody else's copyright.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's something else to think about it for, you know, all the potential fan fiction authors out there, is if you are incorporating some new copyrightable thing in your fan fiction, it could cause you some problems in asserting that down the road. Yeah.
How is it possible to write a story about Abe Lincoln as a vampire hunter?
Mm-hmm.
There is a person existed in history
20s.
You missed last hour.
He's long dead and a public figure.
Yeah.
So once you die, you're a public figure?
No, he was a public figure when he was alive, and people probably could write a lot of stuff about him then, too. But, I mean, there are several things. In public figure, especially politicians, you have a pretty wide range. He's long dead, and it's clearly not true.
What about Sherlock Holmes? Public domain.
I mean, but of course there are derivative works of Sherlock Holmes that are not in the public domain.
Right. So if you use Sherlock Holmes, that's one thing. If you use something from, you know, Sherlock Holmes' Smarter Brother, that's another thing.
To give somewhat of an example of that, and this, I understand this is more public knowledge than it was 15 years ago. I talked to the author of Riverworld. Philip Jose Farmer, back when he, and I asked him at a convention, have you ever read a book called Houseboat on the Sticks by John Kendrick Bangs? And he just looked at me, because the basic concepts are very similar, and he admitted that that was basically it. But it was written like 1890 something.
Similar and the same.
Well, no, he admitted to me that was where he got his concepts. But the book is public domain, but that's still, and yet everybody's heard of Riverworld, and nobody knows John Kendrick Banks.
Yeah.
What about defending copyrights? I once worked for Famous Robin, and they defended it because they said if we don't, we will lose it.
That's more of a trademark issue, mm-hmm. usually, in terms of the use it or lose it mentality. You can't lose a copyright by not asserting it. If you can have 100,000 people out there writing fan fiction, you can pick one of them, send them a cease and desist letter, and there's no defense that says, well, you know, 99, yeah, exactly. Now, trademark is a little different because if anybody can use your logo, then the logo doesn't mean anything anymore. You know, right now if you buy something that has Mickey Mouse on it, you know that is from Disney.
Well, even Mortimer, they protect severely.
Right. Well, I mean, now any big company protects anything they possibly can with tooth and nail. But yeah, the idea there is, well, if I can put that same character on my
daycare,
then people will think that that is a Disney brand daycare.
Well, and you know what, and I know it's easy to bash big corporations.
No,
for being
he signed my checks.
Hyperactive, but especially on trademarks where they can lose the base rights if they're not aggressive about protecting it. You know, they don't want to be chasing down somebody who's, knitting Mickey Mouse into the sweaters they're selling at the flea market, but they may feel obligated to do it because it protects something that is very valuable and important to them.
Yeah. That's why, I think they took it down because they got ridiculed for it, but usually if you went to Legos.com, it would say, no, the correct plural of Lego is Lego blocks, because pluralization is one way that a trademarked word can become generic.
Well,
like, this is a Q-tip brand cotton swab, not
aspirin.
Yeah, this is a pot. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So,
what about using a name like he took out his BlackBerry?
Well,
in text, when you're
sounds
writing,
like product placement.
As long as we all refer to ones who are similar structure as BlackBerries. I mean, even BlackBerry's been back and forth with some designers.
BlackBerry will be unhappy about you using their name as a noun because it's a brand name.
Yeah.
It's a BlackBerry personal digital assistant or whatever it is. But let's, you have characters all the time that will go to a diner and they'll order a Coke and a hamburger, right? Now, Coke doesn't really care too much about that, I believe.
Not Coke. Coca-Cola, they do.
Now, Coke is as protected as Coca-Cola, by the Coca-Cola company.
They drew a distinction.
Yeah.
What they should do is they should sue drug dealers.
Well, they should. It's so hard to serve them.
Yeah.
But you know, here's the thing. Here's the thing about trademarks. If you're referring to it in a proper way that respects the trademark, so you say, oh, you know, he grabbed a Kleenex facial tissue. That does not undercut Kleenex's trademark. But the other area that they can be concerned about is the usage derogatory?
Right. If he's grabbing that Kleenex brand tissue to mop up the pool of blood.
And, you know, look, I and Eric knows this, I went through this with this book where, you know, at one point I had the characters drove a 40-year-old VW microbus. Mm-hmm. Right? And at one time I said it had a bulky transmission. And I send in the script and the thing, and I get comments back, and it says you can't say VW microbus. Like, why? Because you say it has a bulky transmission. It's 40 freaking years old. I'm not discouraging VW by saying it, you know, I refer to a brand name computer as a piece of shit. It was 8 years old. Any computer that's 8 years old is a piece of shit. You know, they just went hyper, you know. Now, they went over the top. They didn't want me to use the real name of the island Ko'olawe because it was a real place. It's kind of like, guys, there's no one lives on that island. There's not even anybody to be offended. You know? But, you know, they may, your publisher may be more concerned about some of these things that you are. And I had a character who watched the Discovery Channel while he was doing the paperwork for his environmental organization. And some use those are bad guys in my book, and they said, no, you can't use the Discovery Channel because it's derogatory. And it's like, I didn't say anything about the Discovery Channel except that he watched it. You're saying terrorists watch the Discovery Channel.
That's true.
And that to me was incredibly silly, and quite frankly, most publishers won't go that far. But that's how concerned publishers can be. And one of the reasons I think mine was because they chiefly publish nonfiction. And so they had standards that were set up for nonfiction and not really for fiction. I got a little off that.
You said that dilution doesn't happen when other people are writing fan fiction. You know, you go and you send one cease and desist and you're fine. Does that change if you say, oh yeah, go ahead, or I like your fan fiction?
Well, those are two very different statements.
Okay.
Right. Oh yeah, go ahead means you can go ahead and write it.
Wait, do you lose
You don't lose anything. You might have a difficult time going after that one person.
Okay.
But just saying that you like it doesn't necessarily mean that it's authorized or licensed or anything like that. You can make the argument that saying go ahead and do it authorizes that one incidence.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Just because you authorize one doesn't say, oh, but they've already let other people. No.
You can license whoever you want.
Okay.
However you want.
Can you, if someone comes to you and says, I want to write such and such fan fiction, can you say, go ahead and write it, and if I like it, I'll authorize it after?
But they're not going to get involved.
If they wanted to.
Well, certainly that happens. Certainly, if you write for, if you write derivative works for Lucasfilms, the contract in which you do that will have a right of approval, and if they don't like it, it'll never get published. But certainly that happens in a certain way. So you can kind of if you're the copyright holder, you can slice and dice how you authorize people to use your rights. And I'm sure you could say to somebody, yeah, you can write this, but you don't have the ability to ever publish it unless I like it at the end. I question why somebody would spend the time and effort to do that, you know, on what might be an unusable product at the end of the day. But it happens, by the way, on writer's side, I'm a member of the International Association of Media Tie-In Writers, and there are companies that have media properties, and that's kind of like, okay, well, we're soliciting ideas for, you know, Doctor Who tie-in books. Please send your proposals to me. And a bunch of people spend a lot of time writing proposals for them, of which they pick one. All of those other people have basically worked for nothing. Mm-hmm. They have no rights to do anything with that ever. And, you know, so sometimes the writers complain about companies who do that too often. We've had a question here for a while.
How do you deal not only with writing parodies, but also people who write parodies on your work?
So parody is kind of, that was one of the topics that we have yet to get to. Parody is considered a derivative work, and the way parody is analyzed is under the fair use doctrine. There's no specific parody right per se, but it falls under the general doctrine of fair use, which is intended to promote purposes like criticism, comment, reporting of news, teaching, scholarship, research. Lawyers are fond of saying that fair use is nothing more than a statutory right to be sued. You have to prove, like, the only time you can say fair use, and someone says you're right, is, you know, in front of the jury. So it still is a gray area, but you can, you know, try to figure out what are the right questions to ask. In terms of parody specifically, the key analysis is this idea of parody versus satire, and those are the fun kinds of distinctions that lawyers stay up nights thinking of. The idea of a parody is that it makes fun of the work, whereas a satire just kind of uses the work to make a broader point, like to you know, poke fun at society or what have you. Satire doesn't require the original work to make its point. I think that there's a recent big case on Gone with the Wind and The Wind Done Gone. Where it was, they said, no, that was satire, because the author of wasn't kind of commenting on the work itself. The author is commenting on, yeah, the society at that time through the work. So the other aspects of fair use you can look at is whether it's commercial or nonprofit, the nature of the original work, how much of the work you use, and the effect on the market for the work. And this is kind of the same analysis you used for the earlier quote question. You know, it's not definitive, but my favorite one to think of is always the effect on the market for the work. Like, is anybody going to say, you know, I really want to see the movie Aliens, but instead I'm just going to read the quote.
The one line.
That I used in this book.
Right.
Right. That's usually a pretty clear indicator that you're talking about fair use. Also, amount of the work used is obviously important there, too. So for parody, too, you have issues of, like I said, comment or criticize the prior work, conjures up the prior work, and whether it has transformative value, whether you're creating something new, or whether you're just, kind of... I'm trying to think of something, a parody that wouldn't have transformative value, but I can't come up. I know there's one that there's a big issue about whether or not it had transformative value, and they ended up saying it did, and that was Two Live Crew's Pretty Woman. And they were and there was a question there also about whether they were making fun of the original song or commenting on the original song or just commenting on society. They ended up winning. It should have ended up winning. Yeah, okay, thanks. I had a brain fart. That's a quick rundown of parody and fair use. There's one other thing on copyright. I want to touch on, before we do open questions, which is what we did already, copyleft/Creative Commons/Open Gaming License type stuff is becoming more and more common. Really, what those things boil down to is they're just kind of very specific licenses. As long as you comply with XYZ, you have the right to ABC. You know, a lot of times, ideally they're simple and easy for lay persons to read. Sometimes they're more complicated. Like if you compare the third edition Open Gaming License with the fourth edition, whatever they called it, right? It got a lot more complicated. It kind of scared a lot of people. But the idea that some of the common things that they ask for is that you properly attribute the work that you're creating a derivative work of or copy work of or whatever, that you don't ask for profits, that you don't create derivative works, that you only are copying things faithfully. And there are others too, obviously. Sometimes they tie in other things like trademark rights or trademark requirements too. Another thing I want to talk about real quick is work for hire. That's a kind of specific subset of copyright where if you're doing a work for hire, you don't own the copyright when you're done doing that work. The corporation or person or company or whatever that hired you to do it is the one that owns it. Now, that only occurs in two situations. One where it is your job, literally, like, that is your job, is to write that thing that you are writing. Your job is, for example, copywriter. Then the stuff that you write for that job, you don't know. The other thing is if there is a contract that specifically says that the work you're creating is a work for hire. It has to be in writing. So if you and someone else agree, you know, you're going to do this work for me for hire, okay, deal. That is probably not a work for hire.
I have a corollary I want to mention on that. Because big companies have tripped up on this. Sometimes when you get someone to do software work for you, creating a website or creating some programming, and you're not careful about making sure that what they're doing is work for hire for you, it can end up that if you are later successful or whatever, that they can say, hey, that has my copyrighted material in it, and I have a right to use derivative works, and blah, 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 blah. So this is not only something that you need to worry about as an author. It's, you know, if you're going to have somebody design your web page or something, and you care about, you know, being able to own that content and own that design, you want to make sure that you're getting those rights when you hire them to do it also.
And then the only other last point I want to make on copyright is joint works. Copyrights can be jointly held between two or more authors. The classic instance is where two people work together and each of their work is separately copyrightable, but they, you know, mush it together. And this, you know, could be a situation like where, you know, you have different people contributing characters or whatever. But it's also sometimes applied where neither part is copyrightable by itself, but when you put the two different parts together, you create a copyrightable work. One example that this, actually, Judge Posner talked about this a lot in the Gaiman case, because, you know, you're saying, well, maybe the characters, you know, when Neil Gaiman just says, okay, I have this idea for Cagliostro, this is kind of what he looks like, he's drunk and bum, blah, blah, blah. Then you have your penciler, inker, colorist, all those people come in and give the character more life, and maybe now it's a fully copyrightable character, but all those people work together, their individual parts might not be protectable by themselves. The other thing was one guy who's, one professor who has brilliant ideas but can't write, another is an excellent writer but his ideas are commonplace. The key with those sorts of situations is where everybody intends to work together to create one copyrightable work. And obviously that is all much clearer when it is in writing. So I think that's all I had about copyright, really. Registration of copyright on the technical side of it. Registration of copyright is super easy. And while it might help to have a lawyer do it, you probably can do it without a lawyer. It's the application fee, copies, and application form. It's all available on the Copyright Office website. It's very different from the process to get a trademark or a patent, which are very drawn out and more expensive. Yeah. The other thing I wanted to mention about copyright is that, which is kind of germane to this audience, is that one thing that's not protected by copyright are, like I said in the beginning, are ideas. And that includes kind of abstract mechanics that lie behind, like a role-playing game, for example. Or any game, a board game. Mechanics of board games aren't necessarily protected by copyrights. Now, when you write those mechanics down, the way you write them down is copyrightable. The book that you put them in, the board that you play on, all of those things are copyrightable. Really, the idea of a utilitarian set of rules is not really protected by copyright. You could get a patent for those sorts of things, but again, that's really expensive and painful. There are some games out there that have some patented mechanics. I can't think of any off the top of my head. I know it's popular in like board games. There are a couple like German board games that have European patents, I think. But yeah,
if multiple people jointly own a copyright, do they all have to agree if they're going to license it?
Yes, I think that's correct. Well, I don't think they necessarily have to agree if they're going to sue, but I think they have to agree if they're going to license. Mm-hmm. It might depend on the specific details of what they're licensing.
How does that work for the like 95 or 70 years after the life of the creator for going into public domain? Is it like the last living person? Or?
I think for that one, it's for joint copyrights, I think it's from publication or creation. But if it's unpublished, I guess it would be 70 years from the last living author, yeah. I'm trying to think of an example. Well, I guess I wouldn't think of an example or something that's joint copyright.
Just for a question for like the game mechanic thing, then you can have a game where you're wandering around, you have to collect three of the same type of area or whatever, and you can build on them or whatever, but you can't have anything that says like, do not pass go, do not collect $200. But you can say like, you get sent back to the base, you don't collect a reward for your quest, but it's the same mechanics, it's just not the same word.
Yeah, I mean, if you, I'm sure you would still get
sued.
A lot of letters.
there was the big suit between Monopoly and Anti-Monopoly for forever and ever, and Anti-Monopoly basically used the exact same mechanics as Monopoly, but it was Anti-Monopoly, the trust the bus, bust the trust game.
So you've created something, what's your first step to protect it?
I guess that
you've already done it.
Yeah.
You've created something, and if you've written it down, it's copyrighted.
The registration isn't necessary to own a copyright. What registration does is it gives you a lot of advantages if you get to the point where you are trying to defend it, either in writing, like just in letters, or in court. It gives you some extra remedies under the DMCA, some extra takedown remedies that you can use that can actually be a really useful tool for somebody who, this person is taking my story and has submitted it on Lulu or submitted it on the Amazon CreateSpace or is just putting it up on their website.
But if you're sending a story or a novel to an agent or a publisher, don't put a copyright notice on it. It's really kind of the mark of the amateur. Because it's already copyrighted, yeah. And they know that it's protected.
And the poor man's copyright of putting in the mail, that is also a, like, urban legend or whatever. Like mailing it to yourself so you have the date. Or
that helps with patents, though.
But
I wouldn't mind having
it. Would I depend on it? No, I wouldn't depend on it.
Yeah.
How much do you have to actually have the copyright protected? Like, if you just have clear notations of your character and your plot, and then you bounce you explain the concept to someone else because they're just interested in what you're working on, and they have, they're able to actually sit down for more than 10 minutes at a time and write, so they're able to get your story out before you do.
Well,
because you didn't actually write up the story.
The idea isn't protectable. The form of expression is. So you have a copyright in an outline of the story.
But
copyright in a story.
But on the exact characters. If they use the exact characters or
it would really depend how well developed the character were in your outline. You know? I mean, that would be the same analysis to whether
as if you took it
because the base idea is itself not protectable in copyright.
Right. It would really come down to how detailed your outline was and what they did with what they stole from you.
Okay.
So I see all these T-shirts with funny quotes from movies and books. Are those considered fair use or are those copyright?
Sure that the people making the shirt consider it fair use. It depends. Are they selling the shirts? Are the people who own the copyright to the movie also trying to sell the same shirts? There's a whole lot that goes into that question, and I would need at least 12 of my peers in order to get a good answer to that.
12 different answers, right?
Well, hopefully they.
How does age affect copyright when licensing and things like that?
Copyrights they don't dim with time.
The specific example is I had somebody tell my daughter last month that you should go ahead and write in this universe. She's 14. And my thought was, oh, don't say that to her. Because she'll have expectations letting her write in your universe.
Right. So the only way I can see that coming into play is if that really wouldn't come into play under the copyright analysis. That would come into play under the kind of implied license analysis, which is really, I think, a little more complex than any of us want to talk about today. But I would say that it really wouldn't come into play very much at all, because what you'd be saying is oh well the way she understood it was that you were licensing her world, so therefore you shouldn't be able to sue her. But really, you got to show
the contract issues.
Yeah, you got to show a lot more for a contract. You have to show that the other person intended to give what you thought they intended to give, and it gets pretty complicated. So I don't.
Now, her as an author at 14, does she also get the full benefit of copyright?
Yeah, she's creating something new. Yep.
She may not have an ability to license without an adult signing, unless she's an emancipated minor or blah blah blah. You can't buy a car when you're 14 because you don't have capacity to contract, assuming you could drive it anyhow. But that doesn't mean that you can't get a car when you're underage. You just may have to have somebody else sign for your parent or guardian.
I think we're out of time.
We're out of time officially. There's not a session after this, so if you've got a few more questions, I'll hang for a few minutes.
Yeah, I'll be around. Thanks.
Thank you.
Something that I thought of real quick. My daughter is an artist. I'm a writer. Somebody mentioned to me recently that both of us should make out wills to make sure that nobody else in the family can say, well, we have copyright to that if something happens to one of us.
That's always a good idea. Because the copyrights would just pass as part of your estate. So,
right. So
depending on how it was disposed of.
Everything that I would have.
And are there other siblings or spouse or something that might get it?
That's one of those. Yeah.
If you are concerned about your rights in a specific piece of property, whether it's your copyright or, your grandfather clock that your dad built, and you want it to go to a specific sibling, you or daughter or son, you want to make sure you have a will to do it, because otherwise it's
going
to pass with everything else to your heirs under the state law. And none of us are wills and estates attorneys either. But you know what? It's not expensive or hard to get.
That's what my friend told me. They said since we're really creative, we should both have something saying that.
In my will, I specifically say who gets my unpublished stuff who gets whatever remaining derivative rights I have to my published stuff, and who has the rights to finish uncompleted works.
Wow. Okay.
The more. And those are not the same people?
Okay. That's something that you remember. Thank you very much. How would you go about checking specifically, like, is there a database somewhere for it? Because from what I can tell, like, from movies or whatever, it looks like, you know, Santa's eight main reindeers are copyrighted, but Rudolph seems to be, because no one really uses him, or they pass it in a passing, you know, oh, he's just a villain.
Because the nature of copyright, because it's created when you write something down, it's impossible to have comprehensive database.
But of the more, like, public stuff, how do you know if it passed the
right.
domain?
We aren't empty. Sorry.
We'll get out of here.
Right away. You paying attention now?
Yes.
All right. Hello and welcome to the Red Phone Zone, where we don't know what we're talking
about. Hey, we do know what we're talking about. You know, we called the whole Hugo Weaving Red Skull thing, remember?
Oh, right. Fine. Where was it? The Red Phone Zone, where we talk about all kinds of gaggles.
Aaron, could you cut it with the gaggles thing? It's not working for me.
All right, fine. The Red Phone Zone, where we talk about movies, comics, video games.
Hey, don't forget that we talk about, you know, Bruce Campbell and Christopher Lee, obviously.
Natalie Portman.
All right, guys! I'm trying to do a commercial for the Red Phone Zone, where we talk about movies, comics, video games, tabletop gaming, all kinds of other geek stuff.
You mean that show we broadcast on Ustream?
Yes!
Wednesday, 8 Central Standard Time.
Right, at redphonezone.com. Now, can you guys just give me a minute to get this promo done?
Sure, sorry, dude.
Yeah.
All right, from the top. Hello and welcome to the Red Phone Zone.
Aaron, we need a tiebreaker. Okay, who would win in a fight with Galactus?
Anti-Monitor.
Galactus and Anti-Monitor. Come on.
I think the more important question would be who would win in a fight between me and you two idiots.
I guess we don't know what we're talking about.
You've been listening to the Gamers Haven Podcast. Subscribe to the show by visiting our website at gamershavenpodcast.com, where you can also discuss all things gaming in our forum, drop us an email, or just peruse our episode archives. You can also call us toll-free and leave a message to be played on the show by dialing 1-877-416-1270. That's toll-free, 877-416-1270. On our website, you'll also find our actual play podcasts chronicling our misadventures through all things role-playing. Enjoy what you hear? Why not support the Gamers Haven by purchasing Gamers Haven merchandise, visiting our affiliates, or just by clicking on our donate button? The Gamers Haven podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial, Share Alike 3.0 United States License, some rights reserved. Some music in this podcast is used with permission of Joe Hero Band at joehero.com. This is a Thousand Monkeys production.
This concludes the broadcast from World Control.